A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you from 9 until 1 every weekday on Share Radio, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, with my producer Annie Weston making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. This is the time of the week where This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online. Join me in the studio, journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss and Mark Schoffman here with me today to talk through the top stories that they've been investigating, including bad banks at it again, big fines, now investors losing faith. What needs to be done to improve the behaviour of our banks, and have we lost faith in them? Rents are going up, and what hope for young people getting on the housing ladder? We'll be exploring a host of property issues, including to solar panel or not, water-based alternative accommodation, and what renovation faux pas to avoid if you're thinking of selling up. What does the UK economy, Rowan Atkinson and Disneyland have in common? Well, there you know. We'll be putting right some common myths about credit ratings, and Rachel's gone behind the scenes to find out what is going on with the energy market. It comes as SSE sees a big rise in profits despite losing 500,000 customers in just 1 year. What on earth is going on there? Plus, we'll discuss the entrepreneurial 13-year-old who turned a tax disc idea into a money spinner. And talking of age, we're asking today. A maths teacher from Essex, 87 years young, has been joined on the school's staff by his 23-year-old newly qualified granddaughter, which got me thinking. We want to hear stories of you working with your family members. Good idea? Bad idea? Let us know. A very good morning, Mark. A very good morning, Rachel.
Morning.
Hello.
Let's start with you, Rachel. Experiences of working with family members.
I do, actually. Obviously, I'm a journalist. My sister's an illustrator. Good combo. So sometimes she will illustrate stories that I've written. And one day, we hope to do a book together.
Fantastic. And so successful is your relationship with your sister. You're even buying a house together, are you not?
We are trying to buy a house, yes.
Yes, we'll get onto that a little bit later on. Sorry about that, Rachel. I didn't want to put a dampener on things so soon. Mark, yourself, working with family members?
Well, when I was starting out as a young, aspiring journalist, I actually worked with my brother-in-law, girlfriend's brother at the time, and then soon became my brother-in-law, on one of his news websites he started up, which was fine, lots of fun. It was good to get a lift to family dinners at the end of the day. It does have its downsides, so, for example, I think there was one day where, I don't know if this is really radio talk actually, but there was one day where...
That's fine, go with it, Mark.
It was a day where I didn't really feel the need to go to the toilet that day, so he decided to go home and tell his parents that I was too shy to ask to go to the loo, so I spent the whole day just sitting there, but I generally just didn't need the toilet. So I think that's possibly a downside, your kind of personal habits shared widely, and I've just told all Share Radio listeners.
That's fine, Mark. We like that. It's sharing radio here. Just not sure where to go with that. I worked with my sister at a coffee shop, but it was fun. Really enjoyed it. Annie?
Yeah, I used to work at my dad's factory, his telecommunications factory, with my two brothers and my sister. My dad actually sacked one of my brothers, but that's another story entirely. So from the responses we've had so far, Eric says, my wife is my business partner. I've been lucky enough to have found an amazing partner. Get ready for this. Both personally and professionally. Oh. Gemma says, I used to work with my mum at a hairdressing salon. She'd always tell embarrassing stories about me as a child to the clients. Funnily enough, I don't work with her anymore. I do still love her to bits, though. And Aussie Mike's got in touch. Hello, Mike. He said, grew up on a family-owned orchard. Wouldn't generally recommend it.
Ben, Gareth and Ed all saying, never done it. Never would.
Never fancy it, no. So do keep them coming in. Let us know if you've worked with a family member or are working with a family member now. Tweet us at Share Radio UK. You can text 66777. Start your text with the word share or email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost, and this is Consuming Issues. In the studio with me, financial journalists Rachel Rickard-Strauss and Mark Shoffman from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website and money section of the Mail Online. Coming up, find out what the UK economy, Rowan Atkinson and Disneyland have in common. But first, one of the big finance stories of the week. And yes, it is our banks again. Six of the world's largest investment banks, including Barclays and Royal Bank of Scotland, have been fined around about $5.7 billion by US regulators in the second and final major settlement with the industry over the foreign exchange markets manipulation scandal. Barclays hit the hardest, $2.4 million, because it was a little bit naughty for not fessing up early doors, choosing not to join the other banks in November and settle the investigations. It is by US, UK and Swiss regulators all getting involved. Part of the agreement, Barclays will also fire 8 of its staff. US Attorney General Loretta Lynch says the bank's behaviour was inexcusable.
Their actions inflated the bank's profits while harming countless consumers, investors and institutions around the globe, from pension funds to major corporations, and including the bank's own customers who placed their faith in the market and relied on it.
We spoke to Kevin White, head of UK financial planning at De Vere UK, who thinks more still needs to be done to improve the behaviour of the banks.
The individuals concerned may have lost their job, but realistically, the sort of people that could be manipulating markets like that, OK, they've lost their job, but what are they going to go and do now? Set up their own firm, something like that. So, you know, it's the criminal side of things, that there should be, I think, some criminal proceedings on it against the individuals. You know, we've learned a lot of lessons since 2008. Going back before that, you had endowment mis-selling. That went on to PPI mis-selling, currency rigging, all that sort of stuff. I think, you know, a portion of the money that has been raised from the regulators needs to go into educating further down the tree, really, and addressing the sort of inherent cultural problems that have previously been in the industry, which are leaving it. But again, you know, we've got to teach people the right things from the very start, that we're not product selling. It's being a resource to clients and doing the right thing.
Well, before we talk about the culture and what needs to change, remind us a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, the background to this scandal. Firstly, Forex. What is that? The foreign exchange markets.
So it's literally buying and selling money of different currencies. What happened here was the banks rigged it. It's worth about £3 trillion is traded every day in the UK. It's big business. And they just completely exploited it, took advantage of their own customers. It ruined or threatened the whole integrity of the system. A £3 trillion a day system, that's quite serious.
It all relates to the fix, doesn't it? What they call the fix. So 40% of all trades, I believe, are done in London. And they said that 4pm was the time, 30 seconds before 4pm, 30 seconds after was when they got a general idea of how much investments were worth. So everyone was putting all of those trades in that time. Now, they've expanded that to 5 minutes. But we're talking here about $5.7 billion of fines. But in total, the whole industry is worth about $6 trillion a day. So this is a drop in the ocean, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tiny. And you just have to ask how much they can keep going with fines, and if there's any more action that needs to be taken, like if they need actual reprimands of individuals. But then it's just where does the buck stop, I guess? Is it the bank's policy, or is it just a few rogue traders?
We said, where else do you go there? I mean, it's rare for a company to be found guilty of criminal behaviour. We shouldn't forget this is criminal behaviour, but therefore should we see criminal prosecutions?
We hope so. I mean, that only 6 people have been fired so far at Barclays seems extraordinary. We hope that there'll be some sort of criminal implications as well. But rarely do we see that happen. There's always a transition in management, and they say, oh, well, it wasn't us, and had we been there and the people before us. Where does the buck stop? So rarely does there seem to be a sense of culpability. And it just is endless. I sometimes lose track these days of which fine is which for what. Is this Forex? Is this LIBOR? And almost to get a sense of the quantity of these things, of fines and their millions and billions, I almost think that we've become sort of anaesthetised to just how serious these fines are, and the practices of the banks where we all keep our money.
I mean, if we're becoming like that, then imagine what the banks are. It's actually doing anything. Take Barclays, for example. So paid by far the biggest of the fines, they handed over $1.5 billion to the regulators, $284 million to the Financial Conduct Authority. Now, the financial markets did expect Barclays' fine to be substantially greater at around $2.4 billion. So bargain. News actually saw the bank's share price rise, adding $1.5 billion to the price of the bank.
I don't know how long it's going to take, really, to build back the reputation of our banking system when we just, almost, it's old news. We don't even pay attention to these fines because we just expect our banking institutions to have been up to this sort of mischief.
What about breaking up the banks, Mark?
I mean, that's one of the arguments to make them behave better. And it's this whole idea of casino banking where you separate kind of the investment banking, the speculative side, from the retail bank that's giving us our kind of mortgages and loans and credit cards. And the idea would be that normal customers wouldn't be affected. But even doing that, you'd still be affected in some ways by LIBOR fixing or Forex fixing, if it's wherever it's with currency rates or kind of the price of your mortgage. It's still going to hit you.
So we've explored criminal prosecutions, breaking up the banks. You said, where does the buck stop there? I mean, of course, Bob Diamond at Barclays was forced out when the LIBOR scandal broke in 2012. And now we're seeing Deutsche Bank hit by a shareholder investor revolt, delivering a strong vote of disapproval of the German banking giant's annual meeting. Apparently, 39% of investors refused to support the performances of the co-chief execs. Last time it was 89% of those attending the meeting, and a lot of that had to do with the mounting regulatory fines. Is this the only way that something's going to happen?
I think shareholder action is pretty important. Like, if you look at what the way some oil companies have changed their practices, particularly where you have big pension funds or like the Church of England, which recently withdrew from kind of fossil fuel investments, I think if you can get big active investors to use their sway and actually try and make a change, that could be one way of making a difference.
Where did all these billions go?
I think the Treasury, well, I think certainly the LIBOR fines were used to go to some armed forces charities, and there was talk of the fines going to other good causes. So maybe this is a way of the banks being socially responsible. I don't know. You get fined and then you help a charity.
We heard Kevin White, head of UK financial planning, saying there needs to be a cultural change in the finance industry. Bankers don't have the best reputation, do they?
Well, it's almost so bad that we just assume that they're going to be bad now. Should another billion pound fine come out tomorrow, I don't think that would hurt them any more than they are already. But at the same time, no one changes their bank account. I don't know that Barclays will lose any consumer customers as a result of this. People get upset about it. They read the headlines. They think naughty bankers, but who switches?
And yet we see Deutsche Bank, HSBC, feeling they're in a position where they can threaten to leave Britain.
Well, this is the idea that the UK has a massive financial services industry. It's one of our main economies, and it's not just banking that it feeds into, but it links up with kind of the legal industry and accountancy, and then there's all the services that feed into it. So that's the problem. If you clamp down too much on the banks, then you sort of affect everything else.
In the studio with me, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, Mark Schoffman from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of The Mail Online. You're listening to Consuming Issues.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
So we've spoken about our banks. Let's turn our attention to our economy. And prices in Britain have fell for the first time since 1955, as inflation turns negative by 0.1% in April. To give that some historical context, 55 was the year that Rowan Atkinson and Bill Gates were born, Disneyland opened in California, and Cardiff was declared the capital of Wales. So should we all be celebrating? Not that Cardiff was declared the capital of Wales. Great for them, though. But the prices have gone retro. Just tell us a little bit, what's behind this drop in prices? Mark, starting with you.
So in the past few months, we saw the oil price fall close to $50 a barrel, I think, which is a big factor in the inflation figure. And also food prices have fallen as well. And that all has pushed inflation or the cost of living down and into what we now are calling deflation. It sounds like a good thing because suddenly things are cheaper, but then the risk is that people keep expecting things to fall and keep getting cheaper, so possibly delay their spending.
It is really down to fuel prices at the pumps, and also these supermarket price wars are driving down prices at the checkouts. But even if you take out those two things, everything really is stagnating prices anyway. So as Mark says, the fear is that we will all think, oh, well, if it's going to be cheaper next month, I won't bother buying it now. But the Bank of England said last month that there are no signs of the British population looking towards delayed gratification. And certainly the bank seems to be talking up this idea of deflation. Woohoo, let's go spend all our money because things are getting cheaper.
Yes, indeed. The way they're all talking is so this, they planned it all along. But then you'd ask the question, why on earth have 6 years of 0.5% interest rates and then you have a target of 2% inflation, quantitative easing and essentially free money to the banks for the funding for lending scheme? What was the point in all that if the ultimate goal was deflation? It certainly wasn't, was it, Mark?
I don't think that's their goal at all, but they do need kind of this period where people are starting to be encouraged to spend again so that then ultimately they can start raising interest rates and start kind of having a bit more control.
But also, if you look at the numbers at the moment around spending, and also particularly worryingly, I think, around debt, people are spending more on the high street at the moment and they're taking out much more debt. PwC thinks that at this rate, we could all have 10 grand per household of unsecured debt. It's quite serious. And then when we talk about interest rates rising, well, if the cost of servicing your debt starts to go up and it eats more and more into your disposable income, people are going to struggle. It won't be mortgages that they'll sacrifice on. You know, people will still manage to keep their homes and pay their bills, but it'll be other less essential spending that will go. And those sorts of things grind the economy to a halt.
Going with what the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney is saying, enjoy it while it lasts.
I think that's precisely what he'd like us to do. but I don't, I'm not so sure about this advice. I mean, perhaps for the economy as a whole, that's good advice. But if you're in pots of debt already, just because interest rates are low and prices are low and you quite fancy buying something now, I don't know in the long term for individual households that's necessarily a good idea.
What's also interesting about this, though, is core inflation fell. Because this can't be good news for the economy generally.
It's fallen to 0.8%, which is well below the Bank of England's target of 2%. So once you take out, we don't talk about housing costs and inflation anyway, but so once you take out other things, recreation.
Which seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Because if ever there were somewhere in the economy where we were seeing inflation, you would argue that it would be the housing market.
Which we will get on to.
I can tell you about that.
Yes, indeed. Your own personal experience with that one. I guess what we haven't mentioned here is it's rising interest rates, good for savers.
Well, yeah, if the banks...
yes, pass it on, of course.
Yeah, but ultimately, yeah, savers have obviously had a bit of a tough time for the past 7 years, 6 years. Mm-hmm. Whenever interest rates went down in 2009.
March 2009.
Yeah. So savings rates have fallen to very low levels and it's hard to get a decent deal. So you'd hope the banks would pass it on, but... We've already spoken about how trustworthy they are, but who knows?
Oh, Mark. Talking about trustworthy, to the energy market, shall we? And gas and electricity company SSE has seen their profits rise by 39%, despite losing a whopping 500,000 customers in just 1 year. Now, Rachel, you've been looking into this. What's going on here?
It sounds like wizardry, doesn't it? That you could see your profits go up 39% but still lose 500,000 customers, and also there are existing customers are now using 13% less energy than they were 5 years ago. So how have they managed this, we ask? Well, the cynic says that they need to cut their bills for customers in light of the recent falls in wholesale prices, which they haven't done. All of the energy companies, the big six, made a big fuss about Ed Miliband's pledge to freeze prices should there have been a Labour government. And they all said it creates too much uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen. We can't possibly pass on wholesale price cuts to our customers. Now we've got a Conservative government and they're all just keeping shtum. Yet again, SSE have pointed their finger at these, what they call the green levies on our bills, and say that, well, if the government took those off bills and put them into taxation in some form, which is probably not a bad idea, then we would be able to cut bills. So taking no responsibility whatsoever.
How have customers responded to this?
Well, I mean, 500,000 gone, that's quite good. And this is despite their price freeze, which sounds quite good, doesn't it, freezing prices? It gives you reliability, but it also means that your prices, that your bills on these fixed tariffs won't have gone down.
Why have they left? They can't be alone on this,
well,
surely.
Because there are better deals around.
Where are they going? To the challenger firms?
Yeah, they're doing very well. First Utility's doing very well. OVO's doing very well. Yeah, people are shifting around. There's been so much talk for years. We've gone on and on, banging on and on about switch, switch, switch. And I think people are starting to do it. 2 million have gone to the challengers so far.
If you fixed last year when it was all the talk of the price freeze, you'd probably be paying about, on average, £1,400 or £1,200 or something. And now the average bills are around 900, just over £900.
How easy is it to switch?
Should be really easy. If you go through a switching site, then you find out what savings you can make, find the best deal. It's all done between the energy suppliers. They pick a day that you switch over. Shouldn't be a problem.
We offer an energy helpline service on This Is Money, where you can just put your postcode in and say how much you're currently paying, and then it will come up with lots of figures about how much you could save.
The Competition and Markets Authority is also at the moment currently undertaking a wide-ranging probe into the energy market to see if customers are being unfairly treated by the Big Six. We hear a lot about the energy market being broken. Are we any closer to it being fixed?
Well, the preliminary findings suggested what I think we all knew, was that loyal customers get ripped off at the expense of those who switch about. Unfortunately, loyal customers tend to be, and we say loyal, it's rubbish, isn't it? It's just people who don't move. It doesn't necessarily mean that they like their supplier. And it tends to be older people who don't have internet access, poorer households. These are not the types of people who you want to be ripping off with inflated bills so that you can pass on savings to those who switch round.
Now, Rachel, I gather you've been behind the scenes at Npower.
I had a lovely day at Rainton Bridge, which is near Durham, which is the biggest call centre of Npower.
It's a long way to go, isn't it? It's a long old poke to Durham.
Yeah, it's good. Beautiful trip,
I know,
actually.
Isn't it? Lovely yeah. area. But what did you find there?
So they invited me, actually, to see how they were getting along. Npower's customer service has had a lot to be desired for the last couple of years. They were 6th out of 6th for customer service for quite some time, and they're now 5th, which they're pretty excited about. But that's because Scottish Power have just got so rubbish recently. But they say that they're turning things around and everything's going to be much better from now on. And they were showing me around how this is coming about. So I talked to people who were answering the phone calls when you phone up to make a complaint, and I talked to the chief executive about what's going on.
That job must be not chief executive. The answering phone calls must be one of the most thankless tasks ever. We forget about that, the people on the other end of the phone, when we're complaining about it, and there are a lot of complaints being made to the energy firms. What were they like?
Yes, there was some resignation, but they seemed quite committed to what they were doing, actually. It's true that we forget about those people on the other side of the phone, but what I learned is that you shouldn't, because you should be a nice person and don't give them a hard time, but two, because they do have quite a bit of power. I was told that they could give out £25 in compensation without sort of having to ask around too much. I sat in on one call where someone asked if they could delay a payment for 2 weeks, and that was just not a problem. The person could put that through and put a note on their file so that they don't get any more of those horrible letters saying, you owe us this, and then it comes back the next week in red letters and red and underlined. That was all going to stop. There is quite a lot that they can do, so be really nice.
Isn't that worrying, though, that you have to be nice in order for them to give you what essentially you should be owed anyway, if you are in the right?
It's true, but there's owed and there's owed. There's a grey line. It's a bit of a grey area around compensation. Do you deserve £25 versus £10?
But if they're able to give it to it, why should you? One person get 25, one person get 10? I don't know.
Well, it's true that, of course, it won't necessarily be those who are most polite who will get it, of course. It might be those who are most insistent. Also, I discovered there's an executive complaints team. So actually, if you do want a bit more compensation, that's where you go to complain to the chief executive or to your MP or to the media, actually. This
Good
is money.co.uk. Get in touch if you're having problems with any of your energy suppliers or indeed any consumer issue.
Because you're in there with Npower now, aren't you? You've been up there to Durham.
Maybe no longer.
But was it worth it? What did you learn from the whole experience? As a journalist, what did you find out?
I think that they are trying to turn things round, and they've realised finally, what it is that people require out of customer service. I mean, really, people don't want to talk to their energy supplier at all. And I think that they're cottoning onto that and coming up with apps that will stop anyone having to phone a call centre at all. And they are taking customer service seriously.
That voice you're hearing is Rachel Rickard-Strauss, joined in the studio by Mark Shoffman from This Is Money. Coming up, while living on a houseboat could be the one answer to getting on the property ladder.
Morning Money. The markets, the papers and the city. Today's Need to Know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost and this is Share Radio. Now, lots of property stories on This Is Money. But firstly, Rachel and Mark, I want to draw your attention, if you wouldn't mind, to a recent property story that's warning that a number of young people able to get on the property ladder in England could halve by 2020 unless urgent government action is taken. Now, the housing charity Shelter say that if things stay as they are, fewer than a fifth of 25 to 34-year-olds will own their own home by the end of the current parliament, which compares with almost 60% a decade ago. Well, Andy McGee is 29. He's married and lives with his parents. He says he just can't afford to move out.
Well, there's various schemes out there and things, but the biggest problem is really getting enough money together to get the deposit. Now, obviously, we've taken the approach to stay with my parents to save up as much as we possibly can so that we can get a deposit in a few years' time. The alternative would be just to rent, in which case we will never be able to save up for a deposit.
Now, I want your reaction to this story. Rachel, you're actually in this age group and you're actually looking for a house at the moment. So starting with you, your personal experiences on this one.
I'm trying to, yes. Bad news this morning, though, so who knows? But it's absolutely the case that it just takes so many years to save up. And then with prices inflating as they are at the moment, particularly in London, you know, by the time you've got a deposit together, and then the area that you were looking in, the prices have gone up, then you have to either continue saving or look in another area. And it's true that there are all sorts of government initiatives, and there have been for a long time, to help first-time buyers.
Like what?
Well, the latest one that will kick in is this Help to Buy ISA, which will match £50 for every 200 that you put in. Mm-hmm. So that's free money for the government. But to get your maximum £3,000 would take 5 years, and goodness knows where prices will be then. And the concern here is all of these schemes from the government are only going to push up prices further. And what we really need is a total rethink about how we manage our housing infrastructure, really. We need more homes, but equally the number of spare rooms in homes has increased. So perhaps we just need to rethink about how we manage housing.
Mark, your view?
Yeah, I think we definitely need more homes, and possibly, I don't know, less of a negative view of renting. Like in kind of Europe and America, most people do rent, and it's just an acceptable way of living. And there just seems to be this English man and his castle type mentality that everyone has. And at the same time as that mentality, everyone just seems to want to live in London. So when they're thinking of buying their first property, they're looking at London prices. But when you look a bit out into kind of greater London and elsewhere, and even not London, because they do have houses outside of the capital, you can often find it will be cheaper property and often easier to buy.
But taking the south and the southeast, not cheaper by a lot. And then when you factor in rail into that, I know Lee Boyce, one of your journalists, is particularly hot under the collar about the price of rail fare. But also when you say about legitimising or making renting more acceptable, we hear stories like today that private sector renting across England and Wales has hit another all-time high. Two estate agents saying today that it's jumped 4.6% in April compared to a year earlier. The average £774 a month, and the fastest annual increase recorded since November 2010. Shelter say more government action, but what more can a government do?
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because so much of the growth that we've seen recently is completely dependent on the housing market, the wealth that households feel. A lot of it is tied up in their homes as well. To sort of think about the alternative to that, what it would entail to have prices that were realistic, that were in line with wages, is a frightening thought, which I think is why, rather than perhaps taking a step back and looking at the housing market in general or stopping these small schemes, we're just inflating the market further and further.
Or what we could Mark, is ditch our bricks and mortar apparently and buy a canal boat. This is an article on This Is Money. Apparently it costs a fraction of the house, but it's not all plain sailing. You can pick up a 50-foot narrow boat for as little as 20 grand, as opposed to the average house price of 200,000. I have to say, I read through this article and I was really surprised at how many... You think you're just going to buy a boat and Bob's your uncle, there you go, a cheap house on the river, lovely views. No, loads and loads of hidden costs. Explain to us, if you would. Is it a realistic alternative?
Well, if you're a fan of the water, this is good.
All right,
if you like a river view. Obviously, a canal boat is going to be narrower than a one or two bedroom flat. Probably have to like the person you're living with quite a lot. That probably counts if you're also living in a flat as well. But yeah, it's not just the cost of the boat. There's other fees. There's mooring fees from anything from £2,000 upwards a year.
Mooring fees, they're like parking.
Yeah, so right. This is parking in a marina. There are ways around that, I think. If you only stay somewhere for 2 weeks and then move on, you wouldn't have to pay anything. So if you like the thought of waking up somewhere new every fortnight, that would be quite nice.
Yeah. Might be inconvenient trying to get to work and arrange that. But yeah, absolutely. I think there's a certain sort of person would want to live on a boat. But you can't actually take out a home loan, can you?
That's the other problem, is you're going to have to fork out £20,000 roughly. And that's without mooring fees or anything like that. But you can't get a conventional mortgage on it. So you'd either have to take out a bank loan, which will be more expensive, or if you can, pay for it up front. There are just so many other costs, and I had no idea. You can buy a 99-year lease in Little Venice, this article says, but it costs £500,000 to buy it. I don't know how long people generally decide to live on a boat for. Perhaps if it was only a couple of years, you could sell it on again.
But also included in this, obviously, insurance, your upkeep costs, your boat licence, a safety certificate and council tax.
Yeah, and you have to dump your sewage.
Oh, Mark, you and your toilet.
Sorry.
Chat. Would either of you live on a narrow boat?
Why not, actually? Yeah, it'd be fun for a bit. But the commuting, I think, I like the idea of waking up somewhere different, but then sort of having to get out your city mapper and work out where you are and what that entails for a commute to work every day.
Well, let's stick with the property theme. And if you own a house or a narrowboat, I'm not sure if it works either way, but with lime green paintwork, perhaps an avocado bathroom suite, or, heaven forbid, wood chip wallpaper, then you could be damaging your chances of selling your home. It might sound pretty obvious, but a recent survey by Barclays Mortgages found that our home improvement choices over the past 50 years have been, well, somewhat less than appealing. But get it right and you could add an average of £31,000 to your home, which is at least the price of a narrow boat. So bargain all the way. What are the top 10 worst home improvement sins, please, Mark?
So when I bought my current property, I think number one here was actually one of the issues we faced. But then we ripped it out. It was an avocado-coloured bathroom.
I didn't realise it was such an issue. It seems quite niche.
Well, I think when we bought it and the couple hadn't updated it since the 70s. So maybe avocado was big in the 70s. I'm not sure. So an avocado-coloured bathroom, 62% of respondents to this survey were turned off by that. Also, there was wood chip wallpaper at number two. Stone cladding, flocked wallpaper. I don't even know what flocked wallpaper is.
What else? Pebble dash, strip lighting.
It's a bit clinical, doesn't it?
And synthetic wood. Are we still making these? They do sound very 70s and 80s, don't they? Are we still making these faux pas?
Well, that'll be the interesting thing, won't it, in 30 years' time, to see whatever fashions we have at the moment that we look back at and think, oh, God, how awful. But as an aspiring first-time buyer, I see any of these things and think, yippee, the chances are perhaps this place has been slightly undervalued or people might not be offering quite such extortionate prices on this place because it has an avocado bathroom.
The survey also found that homeowners living in a property for an average of 14 years, over 50% of respondents said they would choose home improvements over making a move. And it comes also as homeowners are waiting up to 28 years between house moves as housing shortage pushes prices up also on This Is Money. Your thoughts on this?
It's so expensive moving house. Stamp duty alone, you're looking at sort of upwards of 10 grand if you're buying in the capital. So for value for money, oftentimes it seems that you will be better off just putting in a converting your basement or doing a loft or something like that, or making do.
Yeah, often staying in your own property can be more beneficial. I think the Barclays survey has a whole load of suggestions of things that can add value, which would make you better off than if you had moved, such as adding an extension or a loft conversion. But even more simple, like things like just doing up the garden, putting double glazing in, just painting the front of the house to make it look more presentable, they all help.
Also in this article, TV property expert Phil Spencer featured. His advice is to keep things simple, as neutral as possible when it comes to home improvements. Would you go along with that?
I think that the rationale behind it is neutral means that people can imagine their own stuff in your home and they start to live in it in their minds. And once you've got them thinking about what it would look like, then perhaps they'll make an offer. Whereas if it's so firmly imprinted with your avocado bathroom and chintzy stuff on the walls, then they might not see themselves in it.
Talking of chintzy stuff on the walls, Mark, I can tell you flop wallpaper apparently evokes a feeling of grandeur and class. It holds an opulence with its root in the 18th century, although it still retains a strong sense of classical beauty to this day.
I know what I'm getting this
weekend. It's like little patterns on the wallpaper. So there you go. Can't tell you what Artex ceilings are. Do let us know. 666 777. Text must start with the word share.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Coming up, why a home with a sea view could make you money, but millions more of us could be set to benefit from falling energy bills and generous payments after the new energy secretary vowed to unleash a new solar revolution across Britain. Not so long ago, solar panels seen as something only rich people could get their hands on, but now the cost has plummeted and apparently it's fair game for everyone. So why are they so cheap, relatively?
The cost has been plummeting over the past 5 years just because there's such a market in them globally as well. I think there's technology coming from China that makes them much cheaper. And it's just a matter of scales as much as anything else. The more people who do it, the more supply there is, and so prices will go down. It's quite exciting, I think, that we have a new energy minister who, first thing she said, she did an interview with her local paper, the Hastings and St Leonard's Observer, and she said, "I want to unleash a new solar revolution."
Grand and words.
It's good, isn't it? And it could be revolutionary. The thing that I find very exciting about it is the new batteries that Tesla's will introduce one later this summer, and there are other companies also who are looking at batteries. Once you're able to hold the energy that you are producing on your roof, then you're beholden to no one.
How much do they cost and how can you get your money back?
They cost at the moment about between $5,000 and $8,000, which 5 years ago it was 15, so it's a big difference. And money back, one, because you use less energy from the grid because you're producing your own. Two, there's a government incentive that's called feed-in tariffs, so they pay you for the energy that you produce. This is a set fee per kilowatt hour. And then there's also an export tariff, which is anything that you don't use, you can sell back to the grid. So you can make savings of it varies. I'm going to say around £750 a year, but it varies depending on, well, basically how much sunlight you get. If you're south-facing, you get more. If you live in the south, you'll probably get more. It depends also on whether there are lots of trees or shadows in your area that will cover your solar panels. But it's quite a big saving, £750 a year. And with the system costing £7,000, you can pay it off fairly quickly and then you've just got free energy.
So plausibly you could pay it off in roughly about, I don't know, 7 to 10 years, for it to say. But then you'd have to stick in that property for that long for it to be worth it, wouldn't you?
That's the thing.
Or can you take it with you?
No, you can't take them with you, I don't think. So you'd have to be happy to stay in your house. I think you only start to get a return on your investment after 7 or 8 years. Anyway, so you've got those first few years and then you can start getting the income and benefiting from the savings. So yeah, that's a long time to be in a property.
But then presumably if you're selling off a home that has its own energy supply and lower energy bills, that would be factored into the price as well.
Well, sticking with that theme, and say you do have a little bit of cash to splash in the property market, homes with sea views can fetch on average £25,000 more than those just a teensy-weensy bit further afield. That's according to the estate agent Savills, who found that England has the highest priced seaside properties, with homes on the coast costing 18.7% more on average than those located 100 metres to 1 kilometres away. So not huge distances here. This compares to 16.6% in Wales and just 1.2% in Scotland. So are our seaside properties a good investment for those who can afford it?
Well, we all like to live beside the seaside. Well, you get a good view. The risk, obviously, is there's been a lot of stories and incidents in the last few years about floodplains and flooding. So you're sort of at the behest of the British Weather, and you need to get your insurance sorted and get a decent survey on these properties to see how at risk you are of that. But yeah, if you can get a good return, and if the prices keep going up, you could do well out of it.
So one of the most expensive locations then?
Dorset has the most expensive coastline to live on, and probably because it's just so beautiful. And who doesn't dream of waking up and seeing the sea? But then if you're paying a premium already for living by the coast, I don't know whether that makes it a good investment when you go to sell it on later, whether that premium will increase.
Any bargains? And why Scotland just 1.2%?
The study found, it's by Savills, found that there were actually some places where living by the coast was cheaper than living slightly inland. And the one that came up in particular was Grampian, Lancashire and East Sussex. And Grampian, Savile said in particular, is not particularly known for being a beach destination. So it may not have the premium that other places do.
Well, let's turn our attention away from property, shall we? And there is no denying that poor credit rating can spell pretty bad news when you come to try and borrow some money. But things may not be as bad as they seem or as you thought they were, because despite what people think, there's no such thing as credit blacklists, and living with indebted friends won't actually affect your score. Now, Rachel, you've been busy busting these and the other big credit rating myths, because there are quite a few of them out there. Before we get started, just remind us how a credit score works.
So banks will have access to a sort of register of your debts and how you deal with debts. And so any kind of loan that you take out, it all goes onto this register, and it shows whether you are good or bad at paying it back. And they'll use that information to determine whether or not they want to give you any more credit in future. So a good credit rating would be one that shows that you are good at paying back loans, which entails taking out loans. It's not the case that if you haven't taken out any credit before, then you've got a clean slate, you're a good bet, because they don't know whether you're good or not at paying back loans. So the idea to build up a good credit score is to take out some kind of debt, even if you don't need to use a credit card, and then just pay it off every month to prove that you're reliable.
So what are some of the myths then?
It's extraordinary, really, that it's sort of the most valuable thing that we have that we don't know that we own is a credit score. And there are so many myths around it. For example, number one, which actually even I wasn't sure about, is whether or not your credit score is affected by the scores of other people with whom you live. It isn't, unless you share some sort of financial product. Perhaps if you have a shared bank account or something like that, then your credit scores will be linked, and there could be an impact of their debts on your score. Old debts don't matter. This register of your debts stays for a long time, 6 or 7 years. The impact of missed payments does decrease over time. So if you missed a payment 3 years ago, it's not as bad as if you missed one year ago. And so gradually, these sort of marks on your file will be demoted until eventually they're wiped. But the idea that just because you missed a payment a little while ago, it doesn't matter, is not the case either.
So what should you do to improve your credit score, to improve your rating?
Well, keep an eye on it. Check it for any mistakes, because you're allowed to get notes added to it if there's any errors or explanations for why you've missed payments or why your credit rating's gone down for a certain product. And then, as Rachel says, just take out a credit card to actually show you're a good borrower and good at repaying, and that you can build up a good track record.
Now, let's turn our attention to a final story. I don't know what you two were doing at the age of 13. I was in school, not doing a lot. I certainly wasn't dreaming up entrepreneurial ideas to change a simple rule into a money spinner. So after the DVLA scrap paper tax disc, a 13-year-old boy came up with a replacement version that'll make sure people don't forget their tax and MOT date. And Harvey's business is now one of the fastest growing in the country. This is on your website. This is Money. Just remind us what the changes were and what on earth is Harvey up to?
So in October, the government and DVLA decided that we no longer needed paper tax discs and that we were going to move on to an electronic system where you just pay digitally. Now, the downside to that is having the tax disc in your car was often a good reminder as to when it would expire. So you could see the date and remember to pay. And if you don't pay, you get a fine of, I think, £1,000 or something, which no one really likes. So little Harvey Millington has come up with this idea where you send him your vehicle registration and he will find out when your car tax is due. And he makes up these little discs for people for the cost of just £4, which have your tax disc expiry and also quite helpfully when your MOT expires. And then you can just stick that in your window and it's just like the old times.
What a good idea. And how's he doing?
He's doing really well. And I think after last week, he will be doing particularly well. This article got 3,500 shares on thisismoney.co.uk and Mail Online and 755 comments. So they were predominantly favourable. So I imagine he's rushed off his feet, little Harvey.
Well done to him. Financial journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Mark Shoffman also joined me in the studio from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much. Share Radio.